What's up, everybody? Welcome back to We Have Cool Friends, the show that we do here on Kind of Funny every week, where we get a chance to sit down and interview our really cool friends. And I'm very excited about today's interview. We have today with us a person that's probably you guys have seen her all the time in a lot of our content because she's been very, very kind to lend her talents to our In Review series as of late. And if you're not a fan of us and you're watching this because of her, you of course know her from Funhouse. Please welcome to the show, Elise Willems.
Hey, thank you. I'm already sweating.
Why are you sweating? Before we started the show, I was like, Elise, we haven't done one of these with you, right? And she was like, no. I was like, oh, I should probably throw some questions in asking you about yourself.
No.
And what was your response? Just a straight up no.
I immediately start sweating talking about myself, and that's not me trying to seem humble or anything. It's just anxiety. And I also, like, one of my favorite things with you is talking about comedy.
Yeah.
And so you said, oh, well, if you had been on this show before, we would have just done a goofy, silly interview. And I was like, yes, please, let's just do that. Let's do that.
I'm going to ask you probably a couple questions about yourself, because I think that your history, your lineage in the industry is very, very fascinating. But before we get to that, of course, it is my duty to tell you guys, thank you so much for watching the show. Of course, this show is brought to you by Manscaped Honey and HBO Max, but we'll get to those a little bit later. And we want to talk to you guys a little bit about our amazing Patreon producers, James Davis, Andrew the Furious Feistner, Jeremy the Zook Zuccarello, and Simply Sassy, whose podcast I believe I'm doing tomorrow, which I think will be 3 days after or before this posts. I don't know when they post theirs. It doesn't matter. Go over and support them. They're awesome as well. It's going to get goofy. I'm just going to tell you right now, you can stop sweating, because my first question for you has nothing to do with
too,
you.
I think our lives are so public too.
Yeah.
So you try to hang on to those crumbs of, like, what's, you know, personal to you.
Oh yeah. Well, we're not going to get personal. I mean, this is basically like, if I were a real host and I had done my job, I would have read your Wikipedia already and just scanned through it trying to find some nuggets of things that people might not know. But here's what happened. You wrote a book, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. It's called The Night in Halloween House, which I read and I really thoroughly enjoyed. But more than that, I watched Dave Chappelle on SNL the other week. And my first thought was, I should text Elise and see if she watched this episode. But then I was like, I don't want to bother her. We're already bothering her with having her on In Review. And she has to put up with me and Greg on The Conjuring In Review. And God, that's got to be annoying, because I'm annoyed by myself. So I was like, what if we just did a podcast where it was under the guise of interviewing you, but we just talk about your book and we just talk about SNL?
That's perfect.
Did you watch Dave Chappelle on SNL?
I did. I signed up for a 3-day free trial to an undisclosed streaming service so I could watch it live.
So you guys are a cable-less household. You've cut the cord officially.
We are, but then we also buy into every streaming service. Mm-hmm. So it's like, jokes on us.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Do you still have cable?
I do. We recently we talked about it because I moved to a new place. It's still in San Francisco, but we moved to a new place to get a little more space. And man, I'm in the area where apparently I can get Sonic. Which is, I don't know if you guys have Sonic in LA, but up here it's like fiber. It's like one gig up and down. And Tim was like, you got to do it, because then you can get all of the stuff you want, bro. It's all online, bro. And I'm like, yeah, it's all online, bro. And he was like, I'm like, how do I get like Bravo? And he goes, oh, I don't know. And I was like, well, if I can't get Bravo, then happy house, happy wife, happy life. If my wife can't watch The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, and if I can't watch Below Deck Mediterranean and Below Deck Original, then I don't feel right. That's date night right there.
So, what's Below Deck?
Oh my God, Elise. Let me preface this. Let me ask you this question. How into reality shows are you?
I'm not usually. It really has to strike me in a specific way, because I do feel like with reality television, I don't get as much out of it. Like, I enjoy it. It's mindless entertainment, but then I don't feel like I take something away from it.
So this is I wouldn't say it's 100% mindless, but what would you say if I said there was a show about a bunch of incredibly good looking 22-year-olds working on a super yacht in the middle of name the beautiful idyllic harbor ocean area of the Bahamas or Thailand or you know, all these places. It's basically just, it follows the life of a crew through one yachting season, and they're all, they just complain constantly about how hard their lives are, but it's not, their lives aren't that hard, and they're all having sex with each other.
Oh, well, I was just gonna say that STDs must be rampant. It must be like a nursing home in there.
But because I think what happens is, specifically for, I don't know if you guys are watching this in a different country, but in America, I think when you're 22, you just think you can't get STDs. So you just, when, if you're in a foreign country, it's like what happens outside of the United States doesn't make its way back in here. They're all banging each other, but they're also banging, like, the, they have these like super rich clients that come aboard that like rent the place. And of course it's all cast. So these are like the worst human beings on the planet, but then they're like having sex with them too. It's kind of crazy.
Even me, I applied in my younger years to work on a cruise ship because I was pretty directionless in life.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I doing? And then I saw that you could, you know, get a job, and I got a call back. But, you know, I would have been out at sea for 6 months, and the people need me. They need me on land.
Yeah, we need you. You're the anchor for what I would say is my reality. So thankfully you're not out there in a maritime law kicking it around.
But I'm sure everybody's banging in that too.
Oh God, on cruise ships? Oh my God. Yeah, there's a lot of comics that do comedy cruises. Like they'll do they'll go on a cruise and be the comic that you do every single night. You'll do shows out there. And it's just, I've heard people say that you just sort of lose track of reality. Because you're just out in the middle of nowhere for the most part. Sometimes you do ports, but you're just like, this is, I mean, you're in a floating city for Christ's sake. So by nature of that, you're just not anchored anywhere. I'm using all sorts of nautical terms incorrectly. I'm sure there's like some Coast Guard guys listening to this. Like
I have to be the captain of my own destiny.
You do.
Is what you're telling me, Nick.
I'm the steward of my own ship. Let's dial it back though. So you were directionless in life. How did you get your start sort of in the online media business?
Before I kind of worked and doing what I do now, I was doing a bunch of odd jobs in Los Angeles. I was working at a talent booking agency, which was really great. And, I worked for a producer, that was actually making kind of a reality docu-series. And then a friend of James's reached out because she had heard that, you know, through the grapevine that they were looking for production assistance at GTTV, Game Trailers TV, with Jeff Keighley. And she, said to the producer she knew there, I know this woman, Elise, I think you should just meet her, which I feel like I am the worst person at presenting myself or my abilities or my talents. And so like, I'm like, oh no, meet me. Like, how is that supposed to seal this deal?
That's the opposite of what I want.
Yeah. She said, I think you should just meet her. And thankfully, like, you know, that led to an opportunity. And so I started working on that show, and it was a, you know, 30-minute show about gaming news. And Jeff Keighley would go to developer offices and events, you know, getting the scoops and exclusives.
I remember that. That's how I met Jeff for the first time when he was shooting that show back in the day. I think I met him in New York. I forget what it was for, but I just remember thinking like, this is such a weird, it's such a weird industry. Cause I think when you and I were getting into it, it was when TV was still sort of seen as the end all be all for everything.
Pinnacle. Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways it still is, but when it comes to games journalism, it quickly, like when I was working at IGN, this is around that time probably, because I remember when Game Trailers sort of came up, the rise of Game Trailers. I just remember thinking like, oh man, we got to get on TV. We got everything we wanted to do was on TV. And it didn't occur to us, because I'm a dumbass and I have zero vision in life, that the place we were at was the promised land. It was like the Wild West. You could just do whatever you wanted. Yeah. And there was infinite amounts of growth because there was no like FCC looking into anything that you were doing.
No, there's no S&P.
Well, yeah. so you start working for that show. Was that when, am I crazy? That show was on Spike for a while, right?
Yes, it was.
Yes, Spike TV, yeah. Right? That was before they were, the I think, Esquire Network, and now they're like something else, I think. But I remember that. And I remember, wait, who did you say got you the job there?
Well, it was a friend of James's, but Jeremy Hoffman was my producer.
Okay, Jeremy, yeah, I remember Jeremy.
And,
okay.
And you know, he's the best. I learned so much from him, and he's the best. In the biz. And
did I ever tell you a story about Jeremy where I told him that we were jokingly, I think we were drunk one night. I was like, we're gonna grow beards, and by E3 we're gonna see who's got the biggest beard, and we're gonna do a beard competition on IGN. And he was like, sure. And then he showed up at E3 with a fucking giant beard, and I had no beard. And he was like, you motherfucker.
But he looked great with a beard, though.
He wanted to grow a beard anyway. It's like how Tim wanted to shave his head because he fucked up his bleach blonde hair, and then he did it for the kids. Sorry, mm-hmm. Barrett, was I not supposed to say that?
What?
I'm just joking around. I'm teasing.
Can I say, you touched on it before, but the TV thing. I think about this so much because I think about this with comedy, too, where you can do comedy online all day, every day. But until you're doing it in one of those traditional avenues, whether you're in a club or on TV, right, in a movie, you never feel like it's legitimate. And that's how I feel about the internet versus, you know.
Do you still feel that way?
A little less. I guess. Because I do think that you see now people from, especially with COVID, you see people from those traditional mediums bleeding over into the internet. Yeah, like Brie Larson's got a YouTube channel.
Yeah, they're all fucking coming. They're all knocking on our door right now. And I'll tell you this. I've told Greg,
turn them
this,
away.
Fucking lock the door. Put the chain on the door. Don't let them in.
Brie Light Larson, a match.
Captain, you know? Marvel. Yeah, don't get your fucking. The second Dwayne The Rock Johnson started a YouTube channel, I was like, we have to have rules. There has to be boundaries with this.
This is our space.
Yeah, this is our space.
But I do feel like it is tougher, you know, it's easy for them to come back and then play in our dumpster, but it's harder. It's harder for them to see you as legitimate, maybe, or that realm to see you as legitimate, I think.
Well, it's interesting because I see a lot of established comics and, you know, I mean, I'm with you too, right? Where I am definitely one of those. I think you and I are simpatico in that we kind of look for, unfortunately, gatekeepers to sort of legitimize our being on this planet. At least I do. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like, I'm still hopeful one day that I'll get passed as a paid regular at a comedy club because that will legitimize me as a stand-up comic. But what's funny is a lot of those people who are paid regulars are desperately trying to get into our space now because COVID's a very completely ridiculous situation, and hopefully that'll go away soon. But even before that, a lot of people were like, well, you know, there's a certain synergy that you get. You can't just be a stand-up anymore. You have to have a podcast, you have to have a YouTube presence, you have to have a Twitter presence, you have to be making content and being smart at how you put it out there. And I think a lot of those guys are making more money on their podcasts than they are doing stand-up, which begs the question, like, which one are you then, you know?
Yeah. And now, like, Conan has his whole podcast network. He's building up Team Coco. He's got comics coming in there and this doing. It's the dream.
This is not. This is not the dream for me. This is the end of the dream for me. Oh. And I have a thought on this because you see all these, like, now podcasting used to be this sort of like, oh, that's a thing that your friend's doing and that's lame. I'm trying to get a TV show. But people have realized, oh my God, you can say whatever you want in a podcast and you can do whatever you want. And it's a great way to really have a one-to-one relationship with an audience and cut out the middleman. So let's make sure all these middlemen now come in. And this is the problem that I have with it, is that when guys like Bill Burr start a podcast network, or like Tom Segura and Christina Pazinski, like when they start one, I'm like, that makes sense because they're homegrown comics. They've started their own podcast. It blew up and they want to shelter other people and probably make some money off of them, but give them a leg up. But when it's like Spotify's like, we're going to get in the podcast game, I'm like, here we go. Here it becomes corporatized now. And I feel like every single time things like YouTube or, you know, historically iTunes, podcast services, things that are like, hey, you can do it yourself happens, there's always some asshole executive that's like, wait, the kids are making that much money off this? Well, we got to come in and take 90% of it. And then, of course, the government goes, wait a minute, you guys are making this much money off of this? Someone's got to regulate this shit. And then I can't make dick jokes anymore.
Oh, okay. I see what it boiled down to there. Yeah. I was wondering where that was going.
Yeah, no, it's all about
you said, this is the end for me. Yeah. It's definitely feels more like the manufactured boy band versus the people that organically got together in their garage.
100%, yeah.
And said, hi, I'm Eddie Vedder. What's your name?
Right. I'm the other person from.
And I thought I'll set that up to see if he actually knows anyone else in Pearl Jam.
You could have. I only know one person from each band from the 90s. If you asked me any, like, I think the only band that I might know more than, no, I was going to say Soundgarden, but no, I don't know any other people from Soundgarden.
That's Chris Cornell. We were trying to think of who the other guy in Limp Bizkit was
I didn't know there was another guy. Was there a second guy in Limp Bizkit? I thought it was just Fred Durst.
He had the opaque black contact lenses.
Oh, that's right.
We were recording with Andy Cortez. No wonder this came up. That's why it came up.
Of course.
Something I wanted to say is think you and I, and correct me if I'm wrong, tell me I'm a stupid hoe, but I think you and I are very similar. Tell me, Nick.
I would never say that. I would call myself a stupid hoe well before I ever said those words toward you.
I don't know what it is. I really like the word hoe right now. Because calling you a hoe, calling me a hoe, calling
it's a great word, and B, it's a safe word, I think, right now, because it hasn't been taken away. Like, I don't think you can call people sluts anymore. I definitely can't. But I don't think you can call people sluts either.
But
you know when you call your friends slut, whatever. I don't think you
ignorant slut. Jane, you ignorant slut. And I feel like, people can, as long as you're not hurting anybody, live however you want to live is how I feel. But I'm definitely on the hoe train right now. Anyway, I feel like you and I we had these things that when we were kids, we built up as this is the pinnacle. The SNLs, for me, the Muppets, like this is the pinnacle of achievement. This is a surreal dream that's meant for somebody else. But God, could you imagine if I was ever tangentially close to this institution? Like, for me, SNL, for you Smothers Brothers, I don't know.
No, I mean, for me, SNL is definitely the one I grew up with, because you'd see people go through SNL and become megastars. And that was the only thing for a kid growing up in Riverside, California, where I'm like, I didn't read magazines. I certainly didn't do any sort of research on how to have any sort of entertainment career. All I knew was I would watch SNL if my parents let me stay up on Saturday night. And there was this goofy dude named Chris Farley and this other guy named Adam Sandler. And then like a year later, they were all in movies. And I was like, SNL, that makes you famous. That's what you do, right? I had no idea that there was like other smaller groups like Groundlings or Second City or the Upright Citizens Brigade, like that could be feeders into that. I had no idea that I could just drive to LA and be a groundling potentially and maybe make that, path to there. I had zero designs on that. And I certainly didn't know there was anything called the Comedy Store, which for stand-up comics during that time period, during the 80s and 90s, I would have been, I mean, granted, I would have had to be 12 to go see him, but I probably could have seen like Andrew Dice Clay at the, or Sam Kinison potentially at the Comedy Store before he died.
That wasn't a thing for you? Wow.
I didn't revere stand-ups until later.
Film and TV?
Yes, 100%. But I never thought that was something that I would do. I just didn't think that I was like nobody. It's one of those dumb things where like I had great parents growing up, and they were like, you can do whatever you want when you grow up. But nobody's like, I'm the kind of person that I need a Tim Gettys in my life. That's like, dude, you could totally do this. And I go, you're right, I can totally do that. But my parents were always like, you're smart, you'll figure it out. But nobody ever said, hey, you really love film. You know, you can make a career out of this. You can go and do these things. And actually, it wasn't until I met my wife where I did, I'll never forget this, I did a quick, like stupid, like one-off interview thing with Ty Root at IGN for the Donkey Kong monster truck. And it was like, nobody wanted to go to this. Ty was like, Nick, do you want to go down and do you want to host this thing? And I was like, I'm not a host. I don't want to be a host. I'm the guy behind the camera, making everything work. I don't want any of the limelight. Because one day I'll make it to TV and my name will be all over the place, produced by whatever. Mm-hmm. But I go down and I do this one thing. It's silly. It's dumb. We put it up on IGN. Everyone's like, who the hell is this idiot? And then like a year later, after I started dating my wife, I showed it to her and she was like, you should be on camera more. You're really funny. And I'm like, nobody has ever said that to me. And then I found Greg Miller, hitched my car to his horse. And I was like, you need to drag me to the top, my friend, because this face needs to be everywhere that you are.
You know, if there's a billboard, there's a smaller billboard next to Greg. So I didn't know they made billboards that size.
Oh my God. But, if I had all the money in the world and Greg was a star, I would install billboards everywhere his billboard was and just put and Nick. So like it's just a picture of me and Nick. So wherever Greg was doing, it would just have me down there.
God, up at be. Nick. And yes. It's Greg's tie. It's just tiny images of your face. I love that because I think you have a comedic sensibility that is one that is rare and is getting lost, is getting a little bit, and maybe this is just, with the way that comedy changes, it's a classic like sensibility that I really love. And that's to what you were saying about your parents, like, oh God, that feels like me so much. And my parents were always like, you can do whatever you want. You know, we don't always have a ton of money to facilitate that, but you can do whatever you want. And when I was applying to universities, I'm from Toronto, and there's a college in Toronto, Humber, that has a comedy program. I think it's a 2-year program, and you write and you do comedy and learn to perform. And I was applying to universities for, you know, I have a degree in political science, which is what I ultimately got, but I was applying for that. I was applying for psychology, things like this, and journalism. And my mom came to me, and it's funny because my parents were always pretty serious that I should be diligent in school, and I was. But my mom came to me and she said, are you going to apply for that comedy program? And it was a reverse child-parent relationship, because I said, are you insane? Like, no, I'm going to, like, because I kind of got it hammered into my head that, like, being creative and those things were dreams for other people.
Right.
And I thought, like, I should look for a serious career. Yeah. Like, this is not a realistic, serious thing.
Oh, I mean, I had the same thing. I went to UC Irvine and I ended up inevitably majoring in film, but I don't know if you know anything about the top film schools in America, but UC Irvine is not on that list. I went there to be a computer science major, and computer science, they were like top five as far as the programs were concerned. And my first quarter, I was like, I made a horrible, horrible mistake. This is not where I belong. I need to be in something that's a lot more creative. And I don't know why. And I think it was because I had that sort of same thing too, where nobody, my mom or my dad were never like, you got to get a degree in computer science because computers are the wave of the future. And you need to take care of us in the world. They never told me anything. They were just like, major in whatever you want to major.
Just get a degree.
Yeah. Probably. I was like, I felt like Alex P. Keaton sometimes, where they would be just like hanging out and I'd come home in a suit with my briefcase. I'm like, getting that degree that you guys taught me. And they're like, we don't care. Just do whatever you want to do. But do you think that, so how radically different do you think your life would have been if you'd have gone to that comedy program?
I don't know. I wouldn't be able to make great jokes now about the Cold War escalation spiral. Probably. I think like one of the things I love about Conan O'Brien so much is he's such a history buff.
Yeah.
And he has this wealth of knowledge that he draws on and draws on. I don't do that because I'm not knowledgeable, but I do love that. And I think that life experience draws into it all now. If I had gone into comedy, I don't know if I would have, especially character building stuff, maybe gotten to where I was. I've been really fortunate. I feel like life has sort of enabled me in ways. I don't know. What do you think? Like, if you had doubled down and been like, I'm going to be, you know, I'm just doing the stand-up scene.
I came to it too late. And I think that, you know, you can always look back and say, oh, I should have done this, should have done that. But at the end of the day, I think I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I think that you can look, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. But if you are like trading, I wouldn't trade where I'm at right now for anything. I think that the freedom that we enjoy, the ability to work with the people that I get to work with, and the friends that I've made because of this career are like, just, they're unbelievable. And the fact that I can sit here and help run a company out of my living room, after, you know, waking up at 9 o'clock in the morning and rolling out of bed, walking literally across the room to just another room, and still actually be seen as a legitimate thing is a pretty special thing. And I think that I just kind of look back to it. I think you got to come to things as they come to you. I kind of liken it to like when I discovered Led Zeppelin way later in life. I heard one song. I knew what Led Zeppelin was, but they never really registered on my list or on my brain until I heard the Immigrant Song one time driving in my car. And I was like, what is that? I drove to a then Virgin record store where you could, like, I don't know if you remember these, if we had these growing up, but like
the listening stations,
yeah. The Virgin record store. And I was like, do you guys have this song that goes like boom, 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 boom? And the guy's like, stop. That's Led Zeppelin. And yeah, we have there's just a whole row of Led Zeppelin albums in there and like greatest hits and stuff. And like, I kind of liken that feeling of discovery and sort of awakening to something that happened to me much later in life after working at IGN for a few years, which is just that I was like, oh, you can do whatever the hell you want. Like, no one's going to tell you you should or shouldn't do anything. In fact, most people are just going to tell you why you shouldn't. But it wasn't until I started doing silly things with Up at Noon and start and getting the encouragement from my wife, and she was like, you should do this. And I'm like, it would be fun to actually be on camera. It would be fun to do these things. And now we're at a place where we can do that. Like, for Christ's sake, you wrote a book and nobody told you you should or shouldn't. You just wrote a book.
And you can name every member of Led Zeppelin now. Go.
Like, I absolutely. John Bonham, Robert Plant.
Robert Plant was the only one I could have named.
No, so. Robert Plant. I should be able to name all of them, but now you're putting me on the spot.
Sorry, I was just trying to call back to our earlier conversation.
I got you.
Can I say, and this is no bullshit, and I'll probably get emotional talking about it because I get emotional about comedy because for me it was like such a dream hurdle. And two, I get emotional with people realizing their dreams because for the kind of the same reasons. But you pursuing stand-up when you did, and I know everybody said this to you a bunch, but it's just like the adage of it's never too late, which always sounds kind of corny and like a empty sort of motivational speech, like it's never too late. It is genuinely inspiring. And also for me, I don't know that I have the same relationship with being on a stage and feeding off that audience energy as others do. James does, though. Mm. And I was prouder to see him do stand-up than I was myself. And I don't know if he would have done it if you hadn't asked us to do that. And it really awakened something in him and made him want it. Like, COVID kind of messed everything up,
right?
But you know, I don't know if he's talked with you, but he was kind of like, I want to start go out and do those mic stuff. And I don't know if it would have ever gotten there without you.
I mean that makes me super happy to hear, and that makes me that literally like made my day. And thank you for saying that. I think that like when we did that documentary together, and I think that was the best thing that came from that. Well, I mean, it was a phenomenal experience. The crew was great, but the best thing that came of that was I got to be the person that I wish I had in my life, which was someone like pulling me aside and be like, kid, you got what it takes, get out there and do it, you know, which I think is important. And again, no disrespect to my parents. They were like, you can do it. They literally would tell me, my mom would literally be like, you can do whatever you want. You're an amazing human being. And I'm like, whatever, mom, I'm going to eat fucking Twinkies and watch Beavis and Butthead and squander my youth. But yeah, I mean, that was great. You guys are just natural performers. And there's something that, you know, there's just something so special about that. And as your friend and as someone who just legitimately enjoys watching you guys perform, I'll be honest, it was part of it was just selfish because I knew it was going to be fun to watch you guys on stage and just see what material came out of your mouths.
It was like a truly magic night. Like, and seeing everybody, I don't even know how to describe like the feeling of pride, especially like seeing everybody on stage.
It was cool. And the fact that we were able to kind of replicate it a couple, I mean, that's the sad thing too, is like we probably would have done another one of those at RTX this year, had it not been more digital.
We would have done a tour.
We'll get back to it. I want that so badly. I'm doing a show on a boat now because me and one of my buddies who I'm co-producing a show with, we have to find venues that are COVID compliant. And the only thing we could think of was like, what about the upper deck of a ferry boat? And so we're doing a couple shows called Comedy on the Bay, where we got some LA guys coming up. In fact, if you guys want to go over there, you can go to redandwhite.com/comedyonthebay. Check those out. November 27th.
That's so good. The kings of rock comedy.
It's ridiculous. But I mean, people have to, you got to just, I guess, roll with the punches. And that's what I'm saying, kind of dialing it back to where we're at, is that I think we have a lot more, because we've had to sort of build these followings and these online careers ourselves. I think we're proving that we have the staying power more than anyone who's, you know, on a traditional television show, who's just not in control of their own destiny.
Mm-hmm. And you get in your head that if I don't do this thing by age 25 or 30 or this goalpost, that I should just not do it.
Yeah.
And well, that's been my mentality for so long.
Yeah.
Until you just say, I have to just start it or it will never start itself.
Hey everyone, we're going to take a little quick break to tell you about our sponsors, the first of which is Manscaped. Support for the Kind of Funny Morning Show comes from Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineering tools for your family jewels. Jingle balls to the walls, fellas, listen up. Untrimmed pubes are a thing of the past. It's time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I am talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. I'm a man who manscapes, and back in the day when I started manscaping, I didn't know what I was doing, and I used to nick those fellas down there, and that is a pain that stays with you forever. Whew, that's why this revolutionary company, Manscaped, has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 3.0 has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so this trimmer cuts on your nuts. It's also waterproof, so you can use it in the shower. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which makes for the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut-free, and smelling nice down there. And don't use the same trimmer on your face as you use on your balls. That's just nasty. The Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0 also includes the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant, and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why are you not putting deodorant on the smelliest part of your body? And yes, your balls stink. Speaking of sweaty and stinky balls, we're also thankful for their Crop Reviver. This product, along with the Crop Preserver, keeps your balls from sweating, smelling, and sticking. And this product smells good. Their manly scent is attractive and will help set the mood, if you know what I mean. The Perfect Package will also come with a pair of Manscaped boxers that'll keep your junk feeling fresh all day. It's time to upgrade those old used pair of boxers to Manscaped's high-performance anti-chafing boxers. Tis the season to Manscaped to get yourself, your dad, your brother, and friends the best gift of all, the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com/morning. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com/morning. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year. Next up, we got Honey. These days, it feels like online shopping is the only shopping we really do. That's where today's sponsor, Honey, comes in. It's the free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and automatically tests them when you're checking out. Honey is basically your online shopping best friend. Here's how it works. You get Honey on your computer for free in just two easy clicks. Then, when you're checking out on one of its over 30,000 supported sites, Honey pops up, and all you have to do is click Apply Coupons. You wait a few seconds as Honey searches for coupons for that site, and then boom, if Honey finds working codes, it'll apply the best ones to your cart. Kevin has used Honey for our business every single time he buys anything, and he saved us thousands of dollars with this great, great service. Honey has found its over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Honey supports all kinds of retailers, from tech and gaming sites to fashion brands and even food delivery. It's simple. If you have a computer, Honey should be on it. It's free and works with whatever browser you use. You can get Honey for free today at joinhoney.com/morning. That's joinhoney.com/morning so they know we sent you. Thanks, Honey, for supporting today's podcast. Finally, we've got HBO Max. In true 2020 fashion, the holidays are going to look a little different this year. That's why we partnered with HBO Max to keep the spirit of togetherness alive with their library of feel-good films for the holiday season. Staying put with your quarantine crew this holiday? HBO has the bingeable series for you. At home with your overbearing family, HBO Max has the movie to get you lost in. Doing the holidays solo, HBO Max has the titles you'll want to discuss with friends and family virtually. No matter what mood you're in this holiday season, HBO Max has something for you. HBO Max has so many classic holiday films now streaming, like Holiday Affair and A Christmas Carol. Personally, I'll be watching Last Christmas, The Family Stone, and of course, binging Succession, all of which you can find on HBO via HBO Max. We just reviewed Annabelle Comes Home, and guess where we watched it, ladies and gentlemen, on HBO Max. So get cozy at home this holiday season by heading to hbomax.com now. That's hbomax.com. I think that's a perfect segue over to the thing you've done recently, which is your book. So how long did it take you to write this thing?
Well, the problem is that it's not like I was just kind of head down working on this or had a diligent schedule or anything. Back in 2015, James and I had moved to a new neighborhood, and you know, I would walk my dog around this neighborhood, and it's a nice neighborhood in Los Angeles, and it'd be the kind of thing where I would pass this one house that just stuck out like a sore thumb, and it was rotted, dilapidated, completely broken down cars in the driveway, overgrown hedges and trees and grass every like it just this weird eyesore compared to everything around it, and it was nobody ever left or exited it. And I thought, oh my god, like it would be the kind of thing where I would walk past it as an adult and think, man, this place gives me the heebie-jeebies. And I thought, if I was a kid, this is the kind of place that my mind would have just been racing, and mm-hmm. I would have come up with, you know, all these what could be inside there. And it made me think of at first it made me think of a bunch of kids playing hockey in the street, because that when I was a kid in Canada, that's mm-hmm. you know, we were playing that's hockey in the street.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then I thought,
not so much in SoCal.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, a hockey, you know, rubber hockey ball going into the yard of this type of house isn't as maybe prolific in the American experience as a baseball. Right. So I thought, what if a bunch of kids were playing baseball and, you know, their ball goes into the yard of this house that they would never, you know, they've built it up as this thing of legend in their neighborhood, and they would never dare step foot on it. What would happen then? And I just kind of like tossed that idea around for a bit, and I was making notes. And then I always like to have like a few things that I'm working on at any given time. Mm-hmm. Some that I finish, some that I probably never will. But I just thought, I'll chip away at this. And I think kind of what we're talking about with stand-up and our work is I feel like sometimes you think, man, if I'm going to make this thing, it has to be the most amazing thing mm-hmm. ever. And I thought, I kind of just want to tell a nice, nostalgic Halloween story.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I set out to do. And I thought, I'm probably not going to reinvent the wheel or anything. And I mean, Nick, you told me you liked it. It is riddled with cliche. I can't even describe.
Well, I mean, it's definitely, it's not riddled with cliche. I would not say that.
But that's how I wrote on the book jacket.
That's perfect. I love how you did your own pull quote for your book jacket.
The writing is pedestrian, riddled with cliche.
No, it's definitely not riddled with cliche. It definitely, but what I liked about it, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you about it, was, you know, I started reading it, and it has a level of nostalgia, and it just made me remember what it's like to be a kid, and made me remember what it's like to go out on Halloween. Like, you would look forward to that because maybe there was like a 1% chance that you would get into some sort of adventure like you've written about in your book. I mean, of course, when you're a dumb kid, you're like, oh, this and everything's possible. I'm like, well, I'm probably not going to get stuck in a haunted house. But I started reading it, and I got about 10 pages in. I was like, I'm really enjoying this story. Like, it is definitely, it made me, it had all those emotions that popped up. And by the end of it, I was like, I want to know what's going on with the sequel. Is there going to be another one of these bad boys? Are we going to make a series out of this? What's going on?
James has told me, he's like, I want you to be a famous author. I just want to be a house husband, second gentleman.
Yeah.
I'll
go as far as to say, if he's the house husband, I will be your butler. I will just do, sit in the maid's quarters. Exactly. And I'll just serve you guys pizza whenever you want it.
Should you drink? I do love writing, and I would love to write something more, maybe like in a different genre, or maybe something else, you know, not with this cast of characters or in this universe, but sure. That's, I do really like, I like Halloween. I like the macabre. I think sometimes for me, like, I love horror and I love comedy because they're kind of similar in ways and sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum too.
When done well, they play so well together. They, mm-hmm. you know, I think you have a lot of nice moments here where the tension's built, but then one of the characters will kind of decrease it with some comic relief, and then you ramp it right back up. But
you are a witty person. You're a person with lots of great observations. Have you ever considered writing a book?
No. I used to want to write screenplays. And so when you said what you just said really resonated with me, and I wanted to go back and touch on that, which is just that, like, I think the number one thing I've noticed about myself is I get in my own way when it comes to creating things. And that's one of the reasons why that led me to stand up was, I think to me, I was like, well, it's so difficult for me to create an environment and a regiment where I write every day and pound out a 90-page screenplay, because I had done it. I mean, I've written like 5 or 6 screenplays in my life. There was a while where I was constantly pounding up, but I'd go back and read it, and I'm like, this is just dog shit. And I think you get in your own way, where I think it's not until you read things like, you know, like I read Stephen King's book, Stephen King
on writing. It's great.
Fucking great. And one of the things you learn over and over again when you study the greats like that, and it's the same across the board, is that the number one reason why these people succeed is because they're not afraid to fail. In fact, you know, the passage that, you know, really resonated with me in that book was when he took all the rejection slips and just kept like putting them up on the same nail. And it was just like a thick stack of rejection slips that he would get. But it's almost like he looked forward to submitting. Like the thing for him was, I want to finish the story so I can submit it, just see what happens. And to me, that thought is terrifying. Like, I've never once submitted one piece of writing to a producer or a production house to look at because I have zero confidence in my writing at all. So when you said, hey, I just wanted to write this story and get it out the door, that I think is absolutely the right mentality, 100%.
Thank you. I mean, it took me like 6 years to finish it, and COVID helped. thank you, COVID. No, thank you. But it was the kind of thing where, yeah, otherwise I'm always up in my own head, especially about writing anything where it's like I'm putting a creative seal on it. I'm getting up in my head. And I also feel like a fraud constantly. But with this, I thought, I just want to finish it for me. And with writing too, sometimes I think you feel like, well, I have to be in this exact set, in this perfect setting. I have to sit down at my mahogany desk in my leather chair, and take my quill out of the blotter and sit down. But it'd be like, you know, there would go stretches of months where I was like, I'm working on something else, or I'm working on Rooster Teeth projects. Or, you know, it's the kind of thing where maybe that day I don't sit down and I write a page. I sit down and I write two sentences, but I still feel like I'm doing something.
Absolutely.
And it might take me a decade. Like, and I think maybe the George R. R. Martin, maybe he thinks this way. That's why it takes him so long.
I guarantee he does, because I mean, I haven't read anything that he's written about writing, but as far as Stephen King's concerned, like, there's definitely that feeling of you're climbing a mountain, and sometimes you take one step and sometimes you get to the next summit. But I that's one of the reasons why I really like stand-up, is because it's easier to create an environment in stand-up where you're getting that cycle done faster, where you're generating material, going up and trying it, and then reforming it and going up
and
trying it.
You get immediate feedback from people on stage, or the audience, sorry.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I really kind of, when I found that, I was like, oh, I love this. So instead of sitting in my room at night, every night, pounding away at a screenplay that I'll never have the guts to go show people, I'll go up on stage and just bomb real quick. And then then you start looking forward to that failure loop, as far as like, nobody likes bombing, but what if the joke hits? If the joke hits, it's going to be so fun. Oh, it didn't hit. Okay, we'll try it again. Okay, that's done. So I think that's why I love that medium, because I think it gives me the same sort of feeling of accomplishment as writing the 90-page screenplay, but it's done. I get those sort of those hits of joy throughout that keeps me going in the process, versus, you know, when you're like, and then everyone won the day, the end, you got 90 pages, you're like, fuck, now I got to go back and read through this shit, like all the typos. And I don't know,
but you did it. You got like that first hurdle. I think we build up our icons in this way where we forget about their failures. And Stephen King, you talk about his stack of rejection letters, you know, when he was in his laundry room with his folding table writing his books. But I think also, like, you and I, we iconicize a lot of these stand-ups and a lot of these comedy guys and writers, you know, the Bill Murrays of the world, the Dan Aykroyds, the Eddie Murphys, that, like, but you forget that these guys had failures and stinkers and stuff.
I mean, by the way, so just for everyone's, this is our own private thing, but you recommend that I read this book, and so I bought it. So we're going to be talking about this on part two of this interview. Whenever I finish this, which would be great. You and I recommend books for each other all the time, and I think we actually bonded over the fact that both of us had read Live from New York, which was the oral history of Saturday Night Live, right? Or was that?
Yeah, it was that, and then you recommended the CAA.
Yeah, oh my God, that was unbelievable.
Do you listen to
the next one in our book club, everyone? By the way, I'm going to recommend I'm Dying Up Here for You next.
Oh, yes.
That's really good.
I have that written down. I still need to read it. Do you read like comics memoir? Like, do you go and read, you know, Martin Short's memoirs or anything?
I read Martin Short's.
I love him.
I read Rodney Dangerfield's, which was great. Because Rodney Dangerfield's another one of those guys. If you want to talk about someone who, you know, what you touched on earlier, where like you're never too old to do something, he didn't get famous till he was like 40.
Yeah.
I don't think he had a whole stand-up career, then left it and came back to it. And that's when he started becoming the Rodney Dangerfield that we know of. Like, he didn't do, I always think of Rodney Dangerfield as being sort of this giant celebrity and movie star when I was a kid, but he didn't do that many movies, actually. Like, I can only name three. Caddyshack, I mean, Back to School, and the iconic Ladybugs.
Ladybugs. Yeah. Caddyshack, Back to School, Ladybugs. I mean,
he did a few more.
There are more. Sure. There are more that you'll know if you're scrolling through Amazon. You're like, oh, there's Rod, but they're not the ones that I feel like get mentioned. Do you have like a comedy hero, like one person that you hold up?
You know, it's funny because going back to our discussion on SNL, I think the guys that I think that this is so funny because when I used to watch SNL, I never wanted to be on SNL, but it wasn't until I read that book that I realized I should be a comic because. I think it got to the part where it was like Chris Rock was on SNL and just failed miserably and then would, of course, go back to a stand-up career in New York and then go on to be probably one of the best of all time stand-ups. And so when I think I vibe with the guys that failed on that show because they wanted to just go back to stand-up and they didn't want the whole...
Sarah Silverman never got a sketch on the show.
Oh, I mean, that's completely ridiculous, right? Yeah. Larry David, of course, being another one, I think, where
his story is my favorite because, you know, they do those crazy, I think it's Tuesday nights, they do their all night writing sessions.
Right.
And Larry David's the one that he's like, I finished my writing at 7 p.m. and I'm heading for the elevator. And they go, yeah. Where are you going? We're writing all night. And I went, mine's done. Like, it's such a Larry David thing to do.
He literally, the way he tells the story is like, I'm in the elevator, and one of the other producers is like, where are you going? I was like, I'm done for the night.
Yeah, I feel good. I feel good about it.
God bless him.
I have, like, you know, the heroes, like the Amy Poehlers, the Tina Fey's, Issa Rae. She's one of my new ones. I think she's so
great.
Awesome. But I have, like, such a, this emotional attachment to Steve Martin. And a lot of that's because
that makes so much sense.
I was very close with my grandfather growing up and he'd come over to our house twice a week. And a lot of the times he and I would watch movies together. So a lot of the comedy that I love, I got introduced to from him. So all the Naked Gun movies, my mom would record SNL for us and we'd watch it Sundays. She tells, you know, very fondly talks about when I was 4 years old and I would be dancing like the church lady in our kitchen.
God, that's amazing.
We watched all the Mel Brooks movies, every like Steve Martin movie. He loved Steve Martin. And so we would watch all of those. And of course, like Steve Martin has, you know, connections to SNL. He's got connections to the Muppets. It's like he just kind of and he's someone that. He's also a writer. You know, he's written some great books, plays. He's
wrote for a bunch of TV shows before he got famous too. Right, wrote for
Sparks Brothers. You know, movies, LA Story and Roxanne are like two great scripts and movies. So I do like have and Conan O'Brien, of course. I love Conan O'Brien, but
Steve Martin definitely was an influence for sure. I mean, reading his book though, going back, I always had a ton of respect for him, but he just like. He was just able to dip into these worlds without ever having to really commit. And like,
yeah.
I thought he was on SNL when I was a kid because that's how many times he like hosted the damn thing. And he never was. He was never a cast member on that show. And like, I just remember him being kind of synonymous with the Muppets as well. But I think he just guest hosted those as well. Right. Like, I don't think he was never an official part of the Muppet show.
No, ever. I think he just worked so well in all of these worlds. Yeah.
But I just remember like his book really, really hit me because when he realized it was time for him to stop doing stand up, I think that was a very emotional story that when I read, I was like, wow, I wish I could get to that point where I realized I should stop doing stand up. But that's probably going to never happen for me. To answer your question, a lot of my comedy heroes are guys that, you know, I was an immature, stupid kid. So I looked up to guys like Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay. And I think looking back on them as adults, obviously, and Eddie Murphy, obviously, like, you know, when I watched Raw for the first time, I was like,
there's some great stuff in that book about Eddie Murphy.
Good. I can't wait. I think that I looked back at those guys and I think I looked up to them, not because of the material, which looking back now, I think has not aged well for the most part for all three of those comics, as far as their stand-up is concerned. But what I respect now and what I think I didn't understand when I was a kid, but I vibed with was just the confidence it took to go up there and be polarizing and say crazy shit and get a rise out of people. And I was never, I always sort of wanted to be able to do that. And I still do to this day. Like, obviously, you know, when, if you listen to me on any of our podcasts, I'm always the one saying something kind of crazy to throw a wrench into the works. But I'm never, I never have the balls to like go full on crazy and burn everything down and risk it all. And it's funny because I was like, well, I'm like, you don't have to have that feeling if you're going to go up and do comedy anymore, because you can just make really smart jokes and it's okay. But then I watched an interview with Dave Chappelle on Letterman's Netflix show. And Dave asked him if he's, oh God, it's so good. Dave asked him if he's still scared when he goes up there, and he goes, every time. He's like, I have to smoke weed because I have so much anxiety when I go up and do some of these jokes that I know are going to be polarizing. And Dave's like, but they can't do anything to you now. He's like, yeah, but it doesn't feel that way when the whole world's against you. Mm-hmm. It's still, like, it doesn't matter how famous you are. It's still really sad, like scary and sad. And I'm like, wow, it never goes away. So I think I just applaud the bravery that it takes to be a stand-up these days. And I want to be like them, even though I don't think I'll ever be great at it. But I think just helping a little bit, and for me creatively, it's great to just do on a weekly basis. It's something to step outside of the podcast realm and do. Yeah, those are the guys that I looked up to for sure.
Well, you inspired us in a way that we probably wouldn't have done. I mean, James always had talked about it, but like I don't know that maybe we would have had the kick to get there. And can I just say, I know that we like to make our Nick apologizes videos and stuff. And I was kind of surprised when I saw that sometimes the community gets upset with you for having these like radical takes on movies and stuff. Cause to me, especially with Lord of the Rings, my favorite part of Lord of the Rings interview was you ripping on everything, because I'm confident in my fandom, and I'm confident in knowing that these are some of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah,
that when you rip on them, it's just funny. I'm not like, Nick, how dare you? You know, I think it's funny. And I'm like, so for me, I love when you lean into all that.
I think I do too. And I think the audience knows that at most part, I'm being overly critical for the content, but I think there are moments where I dip into what'll happen is someone will disagree with me, and then someone else will disagree with me, and then I'll feel it's like, oh, they're attacking me. So now I really have to make this argument that 5 seconds ago, at least, I didn't really give a fuck about. I was just trying to make a counterpoint or fun. Yeah, but now I have to double down because I have a film degree and my reputation as a fucking film critic. I'm just dumb. I get defensive sometimes and I go a little too hard in the paint. And sometimes you always have to strike that balance of like, having fun critiquing something that is obviously amazing as The Dark Knight, right? Or Lord of the Rings, which are fucking phenomenal films and amazing accomplishments. But you have to strike that balance of critiquing them in a fun way or also just shitting on them for 20 minutes. Because who the hell wants to listen to me shit on something for 20 minutes straight? It's not fun. And sometimes it's hard. Like if we edited our stuff, I'd go back and watch that. But like, oh, just cut me out like 90% of the time, because that's just me waxing poetic about something stupid that I had an issue with and the editing of it, whatever. It doesn't really fucking matter. But, and I also sometimes don't remember if I made the comment already. So I'll come back and double down on another comment that I made 4 times. So I get it. Before I let you go, and I know we're short on time, Barrett, I know you got to go in about a minute, but I do want to get to the audience participation portion of the show. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to back us over on patreon.com at the $5/kindoffunny, at the $5 above level, you can write in and ask questions to the friend zone, just like Philip did. And he said, how big of a role did James play throughout the whole process of writing that book?
Well, I'm very neurotic. So I'm the kind of person, especially with things like writing and creative things, where I feel like if I put them out there too early to people, I lose steam, mm-hmm. or I'll start to second guess myself, things like that. So I actually was working on it for several years before I even mentioned to him that this was one of the things that I kind of like, but I don't really talk about that stuff with people. Sure. Anyway, he obviously was the first person that I said like, oh yeah, I have this thing that I've been working on. I think it could actually amount to something, because I have hundreds of started Google documents that will never amount to it. But I said, I think I have this thing that will start that I'm halfway through a draft. I think it'll be something. And then it was a long time after that where I sent it to him to read. And then he was one of the few people that like gave me, read the book and gave me broad notes and said, I think, and he actually gave me one broad story note that I ended up implementing. And it was a really, really great note to go. It made me do like a bigger rewrite to a section, mm-hmm. but it was worth it. And he's just always super encouraging. Like if I needed any, you know, if, when I was self-publishing and if it was the kind of thing where I just needed him to stand next to me and me to go, I'm so frustrated. I don't know. I don't understand this ISBN process. Mm-hmm. You know, he would stand there and go, you're going to figure it out. You're going to figure it out. Yeah. Like he's just always supportive all the way.
That's good. Final question comes from Nick S. Says, why won't Tim let me join the PC gamers? He says, I don't need an RTX 3080 and won't tell me the difference between that and a 3090. Please tell me how to become a PC gamer. Asks Nick S.
This is Nick S?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. He sounds like this is a 13, 14. I
would say probably younger, 12-year-old, maybe 11-year-old. I don't know.
You know, sometimes Nick S, it's not that this is a you problem. This is a Tim problem. And mm-hmm. you need to see where the projection is happening here, mm-hmm. Where maybe Tim is internalizing some things. You know, Nick himself purports to be a PC gamer, but is he really? Is Nick concerned that maybe someone else on the, you know, not on the, someone else not on the team might surpass him in this regard?
Well, for sure. I mean, if I'm reading between the lines here, it does sound like he's jealous of someone else on his team, potentially named Andy. So I don't know if, I don't know how that works out. I guess we'll just, what I'm taking from your answer is that it's all Tim's fault and we should blame everything on Tim.
This that could makes be a TP, a Tim problem, a Tim as problem. We say on this channel. <Tim problem.
laughs> Is it a you problem or a Tim problem? Ladies and gentlemen, it's always a Tim problem. Elise, thank you so much for joining me today. It is always an absolute pleasure to just sit here and talk about comedy. And I am serious. I'm going to read this probably in the next couple of weeks. And then I want to come back and I want to do a book review on it with you.
Oh, I'd love to. I would love to. And
we'll
we
can talk more.
Talk about all of it. Thanks so much for having me. I love doing stuff with you guys.
Where can people get your book if they want to check it out?
Oh, it's on Amazon, Night and Halloween House. I have the link in my social bios. You can see me on Funhouse and youtube.com/JamesWillamsStuff.
I love
traipsing that around the internet.
Beautiful. Well, we'll see you probably. Well, actually, I don't think you're on any more content with us because we just wrapped Conjuring, although we will see you beginning of the year when the next Conjuring movie drops. And I'm sure we'll have you on for a bunch more stuff.
KFAF, hit us up if you want.
Oh, hell yeah. I'll hit you up on that one. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. This has been We Have Cool Friends. We got a lot more cool friends coming up. So make sure you subscribe to this channel. And if you're listening to this on podcast services, make sure you give us a good rating. And if we're on Spotify, I don't know how that works. So have fun. Until next week, it's been our pleasure to be your friend.